I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's been almost a year since the fall of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. We spoke with a young protester there minutes after Mubarak stepped down as Egypt's longtime leader. Today, we check back in with her to see how she's feeling about Egypt's future these days. That conversation is coming up in a few minutes. But first, a look at young people and the political situation in this country. The Conservative Political Action Conference kicks off in Washington, D.C. today. Organizers say it's the largest annual gathering of conservatives in the country. And this year, they say that young people are expected to make up about half of the attendees. Now, you might wonder why that is, because it's commonly understood that people tend to get more interested in voting and politics as they get older. But in 2008, people under the age of 30 came out in record numbers. And in the last three general elections, these young voters voted predominantly for Democrats. But now younger people are hard-pressed to find jobs, and these are the voters that young conservative Republicans are hoping to reach. Today, we're going to speak to two of them. They're trying to get the under 30 crowd excited about their side of the aisle. They are Alex Shriver. He is the national chairman of the College Republican National Committee. Also with us, Soren Dayton. He is the communications director of the Young Republican National Federation. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So let me just start with you and ask each of you, how did you get interested in politics and your particular politics, your conservative politics, wondering if it was a family tradition or something that you discovered on your own?
Well, I would say there were two main issues that really got me involved in politics. I didn't come from a political family. I don't have much of a political background before I got involved. But in 2001, I was in eighth grade when 9/11 happened, and that was obviously a life-changing event for all of us and really, to me, impressed the importance of getting involved in the political process. I also came from a family with a small business. My father and grandfather owned a small business growing up. And so that sort of instilled in me the ideas that I believe the Conservative and Republican Party teaches, which are smaller government, allowing individuals to thrive, and so forth. So went on to college, got involved in college Republicans at Auburn, and I'm now here in Washington.
Okay, great. Soren, what about you?
My family also wasn't involved in politics. I actually, my story starts a little bit with 9/11 also, but after college, I started a software company during the tech boom. And my friend and I, you know, went through that. There was a bust, obviously, that we participated in, I guess, both parts of that. And in the process of that, I came to think about government in very concrete terms as we looked through the process of starting a small business and really thought about the idea of how do I want to serve my country as that ended. And politics was one of the ways. I also looked at joining the military and things like that. Mm. But certainly my family isn't very political. And if they are at all, they're sort of progressive church people. There's a little bit of a disconnect.
So they vote Republican?
They're progressive church people. My dad's very liberal, and my mom's actually Canadian, so she's never voted in a U.S. election.
Oh, interesting. But, you know, it's interesting. I'm interested because this is not my saying. I'm not being mean. But there's a saying, I think it comes from England, that if a young person is conservative, he has no heart. If an old person is a liberal, he has no brain. I know you've heard that. But in terms of this country, the politics are that young people tend to trend Democratic. In the 2008 election, according to the Pew Research Center, which is a respected research organization, 66% of voters under the age of 30 chose President Obama. I was wondering why you each think that is. Alex, I'll start with you. Alex Shriver, who's the national chairman of the College Republican National Committee.
Well, obviously I've heard that, and I actually disagree with the base that you tend to vote liberal when you're young and conservative when you're older. You know, the voting age was changed to 18 in 1972. Since then, Republicans have won the youth vote four times, and we've tied it twice. And actually, Bush in 2000 came within a couple of points of tying it. Now, since then, it's trended in the wrong direction. We lost the youth vote 54-45 in 2004 and 66-32 in 2008. And so I think Soren and I would both agree that this idea that the Republicans can't win the youth vote is just not true.
Okay.
We've won it four times in the modern era since we passed the 26th Amendment. And so as we get back to the issues of jobs and the economy, 74% of young people say that jobs and the economy are the most important issue to them. And as we get back to that and as our candidates are going around the country talking about that, I think we'll see a shift back to the Republican Party.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Alex Shriver. That's who was speaking just now. He's chairman of the College Republican National Committee. They're here in Washington, D.C. to attend the annual Conservative Political Action Conference. Also with us, Soren Dayton. He's the communications director of the Young Republican National Federation. You might not know that the Conservative Political Action Conference actually attracts a very large number of young participants. Soren, about that, is the conservative political action committee by definition a Republican group? Because one might think that conservatism technically knows no party. So are there people like your family members there who lean – well, they're not conservative.
Right, right. But, there's certainly a wider range of people than just Republicans. In fact, I would say many people in the conservative movement in the United States think of themselves as conservatives first and Republicans second. And when you look around, there will be people that have run third-party candidacies in the past. There will be all sorts of people. Don't forget, in the United States, polling, including Pew polling, shows that 40% of America is conservative, 40% is moderate, 20% is liberal, and what, 30-ish percent is Republican, 30-ish percent is Democrat, and a whole bunch of people
but
in the middle.
But so, people interpret that in different ways. Like African Americans, for example, mm-hmm. many of African Americans self-identify as conservative mm-hmm. because of their own personal values mm-hmm. and the way they choose to act on those values, but they don't necessarily vote
sure.
for Republican candidates who identify that way. So people interpret conservatism different ways.
Absolutely.
One of the things I was interested in is the question of whether conservatism has a message that appeals to young people particularly, because another one of the perceptions is that young people tend to be more socially liberal. They tend mm-hmm. to be more tolerant of things like same-sex marriage. They tend not to believe that even if they have a personal value system around certain issues, don't believe that the government should play a role mm-hmm. in addressing those issues if I'm encapsulating that correctly. So I wanted to ask if you feel that the conservative movement today really has an appeal to young people as well, apart from the issues you talked about, like the smaller government, more freedom.
Well, I would note, and I forget who does this poll, but every year a respected nonpartisan polling agency asks a series of questions about incoming freshmen in universities. And since the 70s when they started this, polling on, say, abortion, about, every year entering freshmen are getting more and more conservative. Now, gay marriage is a different issue, and it's clear that there has been a pretty sharp increase in support for gay marriage. But on things like abortion, I would say the conservatives are winning this argument pretty decisively, even with college students.
Let's shift to the economic argument. Alex Shriver, since you're chair of the College Republican National Committee, you've been chosen to sit on a panel called Why Am I Living in My Parents' Basement? How the Obama Administration's Policies Are Detrimental to Young People. So give it your best shot. What's your best argument for why? Or give me a preview, if you would, of what you're going to say on the panel.
I think at the 30,000-foot view, it absolutely comes down to the difference in the Democrat and the liberal philosophy and the conservative Republican philosophy. And that is, on the latter of those two, this idea of independence. So what we talk about, and as the name of the panel, as you mentioned, is getting out of your parents' basement. And in the last 36 months, the policies of this administration have disproportionately affected our demographic greater than any other group out there. And young people are sitting here 3 years off with skyrocketing national debt. They can't put gas in their tank. They can't put food on their table. And they're moving back in with their parents. And so we as a party and we as a movement are talking about candidates and policies that will allow these young people to provide for themselves, get their own health insurance, get a job that they can actually support themselves, and tongue-in-cheek, move out of your parents' basement.
Are you in your parents' basement, by the way?
I'm not. I'm here in Washington.
Okay. You're doing okay. Soren, I wanted to ask you that Texas Congressman Ron Paul seems to be very attractive to young voters so far, even though he hasn't won any of the contests. He hasn't come out on top in any of the contests so far, even the beauty contest. But I wondered if that is your perception also. And if he is not the young person's candidate, is there a young person's candidate this year in the way that President Obama seemed to be in the last election?
Well, first of all, I want to question a little bit some of this argument about the strength of Ron Paul with young people. Certainly in the earliest of the primaries and caucuses, that was true. But when you look at the results from Florida or Nevada, which are the last ones that we have exit polls for, Romney, the winner in both of those, actually got more. And I suspect if you looked at the results from the most recent set on Tuesday, this would also hold.
Where do you think that perception comes from? Just the fact that he gets a warm reception on college campuses, or that a lot of people come out to see him?
I think there is that, and I think he's certainly worked harder. And if you go to CPAC, one of the the things that CPAC struggles with is the number of Ron Paul kids that are going to come and vote in the straw poll every year. I assume they're holding a straw poll.
Are you endorsing? Is either of your group endorsing? No. So neither of you has a candidate.
We're prohibited by actually the tax law that we operate under.
Okay. All right. So finally, before we let you go, and Alex, I hope we'll see you again. I hope we'll see both of you again. A lot of famous people have served in that job before you. Karl Rove, as I understand it, was president of your organization before you and later went on to become a very important advisor for President George W. Bush. Wondering if you think a role like that is in your future. Where might we see Alex Shriver next?
Well,
we want to keep in touch when you become super large. When you become Karl Rove large, we want to be sure you come back and see us.
I'll be sure to come back. Well, I'm very blessed, and every day is a blessing to get to wake up and do the job that I have. I went to school at Auburn University in Alabama. I'm passionate about the state. I hope to return there one day and make a difference in whatever capacity that may be. I've obviously got big shoes to fill. Grover Norquist and Ralph Reed and Karl Rove and so many others have come before me in this chair. And so it's an honor to serve these 2 years and looking forward to this election in November.
He's already polished. He's already not answering my question. So. Alex Shriver is the national chairman of the College Republican National Committee. He was here with us in Washington, D.C., along with Soren Dayton, the communications director for the Young Republican National Federation. They were both kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studio. They'll be participating in the Conservative Political Action Conference later today. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Absolutely.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we're going to find out why some artists are upset about the new categories for the Grammys this year. Some of these categories have Native American, Hawaiian, and Cajun musicians all competing in the same category. We'll hear more about that in just a few minutes. But first, we want to turn to Egypt. This weekend marks 1 year since Hosni Mubarak stepped down as Egypt's longtime president.
There are people running through the streets, waving Egyptian flags, hugging each other, crying. A real sense of just victory and euphoria. People simply not knowing what to do. They can't even believe that 18 days into this revolution, they have managed to get what they want, Hosni Mubarak's resignation.
That was NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro. 1 year on, though, Egypt is still feeling the growing pains of transition from the past to the future. The country is still under martial law, and demonstrators have continued their protests against those military rulers for months. The military government has also charged a group of 19 Americans with illegally financing nonprofit groups with foreign funds, and there's growing concern over Egypt's economy. We wanted to hear about what these headlines mean for Egyptians living with these changes day in and day out. So once again, we called on Yasmin El-Sayed Haney. She is a young master's degree student at Cairo University. We caught up with her last year when she was demonstrating against Hosni Mubarak every day in Tahrir Square. And she joins us now from her home in Cairo. It's so good to talk to you once again.
You're welcome, ma'am. Thank you for having me in your program.
How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you.
We spoke to you on February 11th, right after Mr. Mubarak stepped down, and I just want to play a short clip of what you had to say then. Here it is.
People in the streets here are celebrating, we're like the energy that we are absorbed in our souls and that make our voices go loud and loud and started, and we started to feel that we are the power.
You laughed a little bit when you heard that.
Yes, yes.
Why were you laughing?
I was laughing because I remember that very special moments and very exceptional moments in the lives of all Egyptians, actually.
Do you still feel as excited? It would be hard to be that excited, you know, for a year. Apart from the momentary excitement, do you still feel that sense of jubilation?
Well, I would tell you something. Though 1 year has passed with not very suspecting political developments that has taken place in the process of transition of power, however, we are still go down to the streets to protest any kind of dictatorship, even by the army or by political groups or by security forces. We are still go down to the streets. We are still flood the streets, and we are still awake.
What about your folks, your extended family? When we talked to you last year, one of the interesting conversations that you and I had was around talking to some of your relatives who were initially not so excited about the protest, but you were able to persuade some of them that, yes, this was in fact the right course of action. I'm just interested in what kinds of conversations are going on within the family, too. Your parents, yes. For example, what do they think?
Inside my home, actually, I am a little bit closer to my generation than, for instance, the generation of my father and mother. So I have access to social networks. I have access to Twitter and Facebook. I have access to the stories told my friends that are protesting in the streets. However, my father and mother do not believe in that. For instance, they believe that all these kind of protests are made by certain parties that are trying or aspiring to make the road towards democracy more brittle and towards stability more brittle. So they do not believe in the benefits, for instance, of protesting in the streets. They believe that we should be waiting for the parliament to bless the military rulers or the army to hand over the power in a peaceful way and in a very stable way.
Hmm. Well, these will not be the first parents to have that point of view. I'm sure I'm sure that you will agree that parents all over the world have probably said that at some point.
They believe in the same point. They prefer stability and security. They hate protesting. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's been a year since Egypt's historic revolution. We've been checking in with student and protester Yasmin El Sayed Haney about how things are going in her country 1 year since Mr. Mubarak stepped down. The big political news of the year were the parliamentary elections, where the Islamist group, the Muslim Brotherhood, won nearly half of the seats. And I'm pretty sure you know that many people here in the U.S. and in other governments are worried that the Muslim Brothers will implement extremist policies once they are in power. May I ask your take on their success in those elections?
Okay. For myself, I haven't elected any of the Islamic figures or any of the Islamic forces members, okay? However, I know many friends and many in my family actually have elected them. But let's say that by the end of the day, it's an elected parliament. I would say that I don't have that kind of phobia against the Islamists, okay? Because I deeply believe that politics is moderating the extremists. So it's in their very interest to work in a cooperative way with other forces in order for all parties to contribute equally as much as possible in paying the costs and in performing the responsibilities that they have after being elected.
Before I let you go, this is one of those questions that American pollsters like to ask. So I'm going to ask you this.
Yes,
are you mostly optimistic or pessimistic right now about the future?
I'm very optimistic. We are still awake and we will never let go our country and we will never replace a dictatorship with another. And I'm very optimistic because I believe that myself is still awake, my friends are awake, my family is awake, and all the disagreements that we are having among each other will be dealt with in a very positive and constructive way to our country.
Yasmin El Sayed Haney is a master's degree student at Cairo University. We caught up with her last year when she was, along with so many of her countrymen and women, protesting in Tahrir Square in the lead-up to the ouster of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. And she's been kind enough to let us call upon her from time to time to hear how things are going in Egypt. And we caught up with her at home in Cairo. Yasmin, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am, for having me in your program.
Switching gears now. Most people probably know that the Grammy Awards is one of the most anticipated events in music every year. But what you might not know is that we actually see only a few of those shiny little gold gramophones awarded on the television program. In fact, there were more than 100 different categories recognized last year. But the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, the organization that hands out the Grammys, decided that that was too many, so they did some trimming. More than 30 categories were eliminated or merged with other categories. For example, genres like Native American, Zydeco, and Cajun music were merged into a new catch-all Best Regional Roots Music category. And that has upset many artists, even those who don't compete in those categories. And 4 artists affected by the change have even filed a lawsuit. We wanted to hear more about this, so we've called upon Felix Contreras. He is a reporter at NPR's Arts Desk and the co-host of Alt Latino. That's the online program about Latin alternative music. And he's been covering this story for NPR. But we do want to let you know that Felix knows a couple of the litigants, and he's actually performed with one of them. So with that being said, Felix, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So why are people so upset about this?
They're upset about the way the changes were made. Now, NARIS established a committee to make the changes, and the lawsuit alleges that the committee operated in relative secrecy and the changes were made without consulting its members, and it's a membership organization, so it was a violation of its own rules.
But what's the bigger issue? Is the bigger issue the concern that these categories won't get as much attention if they don't have an individual category to recognize the work? Is it that the people who are doing the judging don't know enough about all these genres? Is that the bigger issue?
These are genres that are outside the mainstream. These are genres that don't make a lot of money, don't sell a lot of records. But a lot of people feel that they represent basically the social fabric of this country. Zydeco, Cajun, Latin jazz, Hawaiian music. Blues, there were some blues categories were affected. Mexican regional categories were affected. So there's a larger social issue involved with the complaint against the changes.
Well, give an example, like Latin jazz, for example. Let's give an example of that. What happened in Latin jazz?
Latin jazz was established as its separate category in 1995 after decades of people trying to get this to happen. And what happened was that they eliminated that category, and now the Latin jazz musicians compete against other jazz musicians in four jazz categories.
Okay. Do you want to play a short clip from one of the nominees just so people have an understanding of what we're talking about?
Sure. This is a cut from the nominated album Alma Adentro by the Puerto Rican saxophonist Miguel Zenon. This track is called Silencio.
Just listening to this, why wouldn't these artists feel that they can effectively compete in jazz overall?
This style of jazz can certainly compete within the any number of the categories. This album features a big band, so it's within the large ensemble category. But there are other genres, other styles of Latin jazz that are more, for lack of a better word, you know, they play on the clave, they play ethnic music. There's Afro-Cuban styles, Puerto Rican styles. Some of these musicians don't feel like they can compete against maybe Herbie Hancock or Pat Metheny, much better name, much more popular styles of jazz.
I understand that one of the most controversial changes is within the Best Regional Roots Music Album category. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there used to be a separate Zydeco category, Hawaiian music, even polka had its own category. And what they did was they combined them all into this catch-all category. And critics of the changes wonder how Academy members can be expected to evaluate the differences in such a diverse group of genres and styles.
Well, let's hear from one of the nominated tracks from that category. This is the Rebirth Brass Band from their album called Rebirth of New Orleans. This is called The Dilemma. So the argument is that something like this, which has a very kind of popular and accessible sound, you put that against something that perhaps is more ethnically specific or that is more difficult or less well-known, like Hawaiian ethnic music or something like that, and people say it's never going to win.
It's like, how do you judge? I mean, after all, you know, that's one of the complaints against the Grammys in general. It's like it's a competition and music isn't really a competition, as some people feel. So then when you're judging that style of music against a Hawaiian slack key guitarist or maybe a Zydeco band or even a polka, a traditional polka with the accordions and all that, you know, it's some feel like it's, how do you compare the two and then choose a winner?
Now, what does the Academy have to say? As we said, the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences is the organization that gives these awards out. The president is Neil Portnow, and you've talked with him. What does he say about this?
They have not ventured from their message that of the need for change within the Grammys and insisting that all the musicians affected, they simply have to compete in other categories. No one is being excluded or denied a chance to be recognized. And after they made the announcement last April, NARIS officials took a number of road trips to different cities to explain and defend the changes. And in New York City, they had a confrontational meeting with a lot of the Latin jazz musicians whose category was eliminated.
And how did that go? Where does it go from here? I understand that some of the musicians have organized a picket in front of the Staples Center Sunday evening before the Grammy broadcast this Sunday. But other than that, and we mentioned that there was a lawsuit, what is your sense of where things are going from here?
I've been told that there have been conversations going on between representatives who represent these categories and then within the music industry and then NARIS officials, kind of back channel diplomacy that's been going on. So it's anyone's guess, really, about what's going to happen. But when I interviewed Neil Portnow earlier this year when the controversy was just starting to brew, I got the sense that there would be room for change to the changes. You know, they would reconsider. Like I said, it's anyone's guess, but I think that after this year's awards, that we may hear something, that there may be some changes.
But what about your argument that you made earlier? And I've heard other artists say this before, that this is art is not a competition. And so therefore, it really shouldn't matter, that it might be nice to be recognized in this way. But artists are saying that, you know, some artists don't even want to participate in this because they feel that it just isn't appropriate to the endeavor that they're, this kind of cultural work.
Sure. And that's a philosophical argument that's sort of separate from this controversy right now. What happens is like, let's say you're a Latin jazz musician, and like, for example, there's a guy named John Santos who's a band leader out of San Francisco in the Bay Area. He's been an NARIS member for 25 years. He's volunteered his time for the music in the schools. He's paid his dues, and he's upset that his category, he's been nominated, I think, 4 or 5 times. His category is now eliminated. And as a member of this organization, he feels a little disappointed and let down by the group after these changes.
Okay, finally, before we let you go, I hate to go pop on you, but there are the popular categories that are more familiar to those of us as viewers because we watch the program, sure, you know, itself. So what's your prediction for Best Album of the Year, if you don't mind my putting you on the spot?
Every time I predict, I lose. I've got this long track record. Although, you know, Of being wrong, man. But I do got to say, I really like Adele. And I think that she interestingly brought a breath of melody and soul to the music industry this year that I think was, people were lacking, which is why I think it was so.
Her album 21 received many, many nominations, is very widely played. And, well, tell me, what do you like about it? And what is it you think people are responding to?
I think melody. You know, I think that just getting back to, you know, pretty songs. You know what's interesting? I had a conversation with someone who was saying, oh, well, you know, this country doesn't really have a culture and all that. This is an instance of, you know, people from Britain, British musicians, bringing our culture back because that's essentially a soul album. And it could be, it comes from, you know, when I traveled through Memphis this summer, I was reminded of just about how bluegrass, blues, gospel, it all combined to make soul music. And here, these musicians are bringing it back to us, and it's so popular, you know, there's something there.
Okay. Well, I think if you haven't heard any cut from 21, then you probably don't have a radio.
Right.
And so we don't need to end on that. What do you want to end on? Take us out on something. What do you want to end on?
You know, there's an album nominated in Best Blues Album. It's by the Tedeschi Trucks Band, Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks. And there's their album is called Revelator, and there's a track called Midnight in Harlem that my wife really loves. And I really like it as well.
Okay, well, we'll end on that. That's Felix Contreras. He's a reporter at NPR's Arts Desk. He's the co-host of Alt Latino. That's the online program that explores Latin alternative music. And he's been covering this story for NPR. Felix, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I came to the city. I was running from pain.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, did you ever wonder what famed entertainer RuPaul listens to when he's putting on those 6-inch heels and that big blonde wig and getting ready to tape a new episode of his cable show RuPaul's Drag Race? We won't keep you in suspense much longer. We'll let you know what's playing in his ear later this hour. But first, we want to talk fashion because today is the start of the Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week in New York City, where designers will be showing off their fall collections. We wanted to get a little preview of what we can expect from the shows and check in on what's happening in the fashion industry more broadly. So we've called up special correspondent for Style and Culture for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, Robin Givhan. She joins us now from our New York studios. Always good to talk to you. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's always good to be here.
Why do we call it Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week, by the way? Do cars have clothes? What is
because
that?
Because everyone gets a Mercedes in their goodie bag.
I knew there was a reason I should go.
No. Mercedes is the large underwriter of the shows. It's a big sponsor.
It's a big sponsor.
Exactly.
I wonder why.
You know, they've been the sponsor for quite a while, but there have been other sponsors, and there have been a lot of smaller sponsors. My personal favorite was the season that Kohler was one of the sponsors.
Kohler, which is the plumbing supplies?
Which is the plumbing supplier, and they actually supplied the porta potties when the shows were back in Bryant Park. And I have to tell you, they were the swankiest porta potties you've ever seen.
I'm sorry, I missed that. Well, so what sort of trends can we expect to see this week? I'm interested in what you're particularly looking forward to seeing.
Well, you know, one of the, I suppose, the great things about covering the fashion industry is that every season you really have to come in with an open mind because you never know who's going to be that designer who kind of leads the way, has a breakout season, suddenly puts him or herself on the map. So I'm always kind of curious to just go to shows from people I have never heard of, and you never know when you're going to see another Alexander Wang or another Philip Lim or another Joseph Altuzarra. But, you know, I am certainly interested in seeing what someone like Donna Karan might be doing, in part because she's been so involved in Haiti and with the artisans there and with the reconstruction after the earthquake, that it's really started to have an impact in her design sensibility. So I think there's something interesting going on there and an interesting source of inspiration.
One designer, Prabha Gurung, is yes. hosting an online digital-only show this year. So is that considered the wave of the future? And I'm interested in your perspective on this, because I thought that one of the exciting things of a fashion show is that clothes are experienced in the third yeah. dimension. You know, they are meant to be worn and seen. What do you think about it?
I'm somewhat ambivalent. I mean, one of the arguments for this particular show, which is not his main collection, it's a smaller collection, but the idea is that there are so many shows and there are so many informal presentations that members of the industry find it really difficult to try to get around and see everything that they'd like to see. So the idea is that by doing this digitally, you could be riding in the back of a cab and you could pull out your iPad and you could watch this show. But I think that you definitely lose a lot when you're looking at something on a video monitor. And, you know, I've looked at shows from other designers that have tried to do it in an online way, who have done a live streaming of a show. And it's a great idea if you cannot be there, but it doesn't replace actually being there, because there really is a kind of magic in seeing the clothes actually move in 3D and seeing them on an actual real person right there in front of you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robin Givens, special correspondent for Style and Culture at Newsweek and The Daily Beast. We're talking about Fashion Week, which is kicking off in New York, and Robin's telling us what to look forward to. One thing, though, that immediately becomes obvious is it's just how global the fashion industry yeah. has become. But it's the fact that clothes are being made all over the world now, and that designs from one place are affecting other places, and that the technology helps ideas move around the world so quickly. Yeah. Is that changing the industry?
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, one of the things that I saw last season and which I expect to continue into this season were these just sort of whispers of a much more sort of global sensibility on the runway. And, you know, so often the focus is really about sort of Western sensibility. And when the industry strays into other areas, whether it's Asian or African or Middle Eastern, there has in the past tended to be a kind of costumey, you know, tourist souvenir kind of tone to it. But I think that it is becoming much more sophisticated in the way that it's represented on the runway. And, you know, the other piece of it, I think, is that it's kind of creating another kind of diplomacy, because as designers realize that there's this enormous market in all parts of the world, they have to understand those consumers. Because the same things that work in New York or Chicago or Washington or LA don't necessarily translate to Beijing. And so one of the things that I know the American fashion industry is doing is setting up a kind of designer exchange program, where a Chinese designer will come to the States and work with members of the American industry to better understand the American market. And American designers will go to China and spend some time there, really trying to understand the consumer. You know, where do these women go to have lunch with their girlfriends? What are the things that are important to them? And those are questions that I think are good to be asking, not just for the fashion industry, but just in general.
Talking about the diversity of the market these days, I understand that time for Fashion Week is the launch of a Muslim modeling agency called Under Wraps. The agency is trying to give young women an opportunity to model while still conforming to the modesty requirements of observant Muslims. And you've written about this, so tell me your thoughts on this. Do you think that they're onto something here?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's a curious idea because on the one hand, there is an enormous untapped market, so to speak, of models who come from the Muslim world. I mean, there have been very few who have made inroads in the fashion industry, and they're certainly stunning women and men, for that matter. The hurdle, though, is I think it's much easier for someone who is established to essentially say yay and nay to different things. But when you're just starting out, it's certainly more difficult. And the reality is that it's one thing for the model to say that she has a particular standard of modesty, but you then have to negotiate the designers. You have to negotiate the collections. And I think that is going to be a big hurdle because you're talking about mostly designers who don't have that same sensibility. So I think it's going to be somewhat limiting in what the girls can do. But I think it's smart because, you know, the world is changing. It's becoming more global. And these are issues that are going to come up and better to tackle them head on.
This is something to watch.
Yeah, I think so.
So one more issue around models. So also this week, just ahead of Fashion Week, a nonprofit called Model Alliance was formed to help protect the workplace conditions for models. And they have some very serious complaints. For example, they say that the industry often tolerates sexual harassment, that they disregard child labor laws. Is there a precedent for this? Is this the first time something like this has been attempted? I'm interested in what your thoughts are. And since you've been around the industry for a while, have models ever complained to you about this and said, you know, something needs to be done about that?
The idea that there's been an attempt to try and provide some protections to models. Yes, this has come up before. My recollection is that it has not been this pronounced or this sort of organized, but it's been a very tricky thing to do because they are independent contractors. And in many ways, they have a lot of issues in common, but they're also competing with each other. And so that's created some hurdles to work together. But, you know, I don't want to say that it's a terrible place to work because it's not. But there's anything that sort of goes unregulated means that you've got some people who will take advantage. And you're working with young women and young men who this is their first professional experience. And, you know, there you are, you know, they're on a fashion shoot and no one's looking at the clock and saying, oh, well, that's an 8-hour day. They're looking at the light and they're looking at the shot and they're asking themselves, did we get the shot?
Just your seat of the pants assessment of whether there's any traction around this idea in the industry on either side of it, among the models themselves and also among the people who employ them.
Well, one of the things I thought was sort of interesting is that one of the faces of the campaign is Coco Rocha, who is a very successful model and is quite outspoken, who has spoken out about the pressures, for instance, to be extremely thin to an unhealthy degree. So I think that her presence certainly helps. And the fact that other members of the industry have voiced their support for it, I think, helps significantly. I think it's still a little too early to really tell because it's still so very new. But, I mean, I will also add that I think it speaks volumes about the industry and about the way that it thinks about models from the sheer fact that they're most often referred to as girls. They're typically not referred to as women. They're referred to as girls. And I think that tells you a lot about the amount of power that they have in the industry and the way in which they're seen by designers and others in the industry.
Robin Kavan is a special correspondent for Style and Culture for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and she was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York. Robin, thanks so much for joining us once again.
My pleasure.
Now it's time for the occasional feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we ask some of our guests what they're listening to these days. Today we're going to hear some music that inspires entertainer RuPaul. We spoke with him earlier this year about his hit show RuPaul's Drag Race. And here are some of the songs he listens to.
Hey, this is RuPaul, and this morning I woke up with this song in my head. It's Faith Evans' Gone Already. I cannot get it out of my head. It's so beautiful, and I wish it had been a bigger hit. But she does a riff in there that just tears me up every single time. It just sends me over the top, and it's simply beautiful. The next song I'm listening to is Carried Away by Olivia Newton-John.
There you are, shiny as a morning star. It's a fiery speech, but you're still out of reach. You never told me loving you could be so wrong and right. And it's gonna be a lonely night.
Now, let me tell you the story on this. The song was written by Barry Gibb for Barbra Streisand's Guilty album. Well, for whatever reason, Barbara passed on the song, and the song then wound up on Olivia Newton-John's 1981 album called Physical. It is lovely, and I actually, when I talk about the brothers Gibb, or Barry Gibb, I get tears come to my eyes because I love them so much, and something about the way Barry Gibb writes and his sensibility just speaks to my heart, and this is one of my favorite songs from him. And I'm also listening to Warm Ride by Andy Gibb, the younger brother of the brothers Gibb. It just is the epitome of the beauty and cinematic story that Barry Gibb is able to paint, not just with his lyrics, but musically and string arrangement. It grooves so well.
Now I warn you, woman, we are two of a kind, and we both know what's coming. We've got one thing in mind. I bring the pleasure, satisfaction, and I got the strength to make you burn, burn.
That was entertainer RuPaul telling us what's playing in his ear. To hear our previous conversation with him, please go to our website, go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bracton Booker, Bridget DeShagas, Lauren Migaki, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Amitha Parasha, Amy Ta, Malik Washington, and Ashley Westerman. Our intern this semester is Bridget Armstrong. Our editors are Alicia Montgomery and Ahmad Omar. Special thanks to NPR's librarians. Our director is Arjun Hutchins. Our senior producers this week are Devar Ardalan and Emily Oxenschlager. The technical director is Neil Tivolt. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. Our executive producer is Tashima Walker. And remember, to tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.